From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember bassist Percy Heath. He was a charter member of the Modern Jazz Quartet and played with the group for four decades. Over the years, Heath played with Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane, and Ornette Coleman. He died yesterday at 81. Also, Everyman Funny Man Bob Newhart. The first season of The Bob Newhart Show is just out on DVD. And a review of A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. That's the Modern Jazz Quartet, recorded in 1955. Percy Heath, a member of the Modern Jazz Quartet and a bass player who worked with most of the leading jazz artists of the second half of the 20th century, died yesterday of bone cancer. He was 81. Percy Heath was born in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1923 and grew up in Philadelphia. He and his two brothers, Jimmy and Albert, all became noted jazz musicians. In 1950, Percy and Jimmy moved to New York and joined Dizzy Gillespie's band. 2 years later, Percy and three other Gillespie sidemen, Milt Jackson, John Lewis, and Kenny Clark, formed the Modern Jazz Quartet. The MJQ, as fans call it, stayed together until 1974 with only one change in its roster. Then Percy teamed with siblings Jimmy and Albert as the Heath Brothers and played with them until the Modern Jazz Quartet reunited in the early 1980s. In the mid-90s, when Percy finally tired of touring, the MJQ quietly faded away. Percy's brothers are still alive, and he's also survived by his wife, June, and their three sons. By his own count, Percy Heath played on more than 300 records during his lifetime. He played with Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, and Miles Davis. During World War II, he was a pilot and a member of the now-famous Tuskegee Airmen. Terry spoke with Percy Heath in 1986. She asked him about becoming a pilot.
You were, drafted into the military during World War II, and if I'm not mistaken, you were one of the first black fighter pilots.
I wasn't one of the first. I was one of the 500 that got their wings and were commissioned from Tuskegee. It was then the Tuskegee Army Air Force, which was also segregated. And ironically... when I was about 18 years old and registered for the draft, I was working with my father, an apprentice mechanic, and I decided with this mechanical knowledge that I was going to go down and volunteer to become an aircraft mechanic. And I went through all this physical and booga-booga and examinations and everything and specified what I'd like to be and whatnot. And... This at the end of the interview, this guy stamped 4F on my papers there, and he says, you don't weigh enough. I was really a frail, small person with a violin. You know, I had a rough time getting through school like that, too, and named Percy on top of that. But anyhow, instead of this sergeant telling me, look, we don't have any place to send a black man in this segregated Air Force to become a mechanic. Instead of him telling me that, he told me I was underweight and I was rejected for that reason. So I went back home and told Mama, well, I don't have to worry about getting drafted, Mama. I'm too skinny, and they rejected me. And about a year and a half later, my number came up, and I went through the same physical. And I told the guy, I said, Mama, I said, well, I'll be right back. I'm just going down here, formality, you know. They're not going to take me. And this guy stamped 1A on my papers. I said, wait a minute, what happened? He says, oh, don't worry, we'll fatten you up. And this was being drafted into the regular Army, which was mainly serving in supplies or something like that. And they had one tank division that was black, and not very many of the combat groups were black. But all of a sudden, in that interim, some congressman had spoken up or something and said, why are there no black pilots? And so for tokenism, they gave us the school in Tuskegee. In the meantime, I had made a score that actually qualified me to become a pilot, bombardier, or navigator. So anyhow, I made it, and ironically, instead of a mechanic, I was a fighter pilot.
So you came back from World War II as a second lieutenant and fighter pilot. Did that give you any new ideas of what you wanted to do professionally?
It made up my mind for me, Terry, that after being an officer and a gentleman and flying airplanes around and having that status, that I didn't want to be an automobile mechanic again. So that's when I had to decide to go back to music, which there was an interim of about 10 years during which period I had appeared and sang on a Sunday morning kitty hour, the sepia kitty hour, if you... everything in Philadelphia was so segregated. You know, I, you think about it, it's amazing that they call it the city of brotherly love, you know.
Like even the kids' shows were segregated.
Yeah, because even the kitty hours were segregated. Like there was a Horn and Hardart kitty hour on Sunday morning, and then there was... Right after that was the Parisian Tailor Kitty Hour, which the black kids appeared on. And it's really a funny city to be called the seat of liberty and government and all that. So that's really one reason why I left here in 1949. I was in an integrated situation then, and policemen were stopping us on the street asking my wife, since then she's become my wife, was she all right? And we're coming from a neighborhood movie, holding hands, you know, and things like that.
You became the house bassist at the Downbeat Club in Philadelphia. While you were playing at the Downbeat, your home, I think, became a gathering place for musicians from town and for visiting musicians, too.
It became that, and it was, like I say, with the drums later when Tootie started playing. It was set up in the living room. It was always a jam session of some kind, and then there was always record listening in the basement. We had the basement fixed up so we could do it later at night, you know, and tune into Symphony Sid and programs like that from New York. But Jimmy's band members used to come down and rehearse at the house. And
did your parents mind, or did the neighbors complain?
My mother, the greatest lady that ever lived. She... You know, later on it became, you'd wake up after being up late at night. We'd wake up a little later, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. My mother would be down there playing Charlie Parker, doing her housework, you know. It was really beautiful. She enjoyed that music. And they were very proud of our achievements in that field, because being involved with music and seeing us develop like that and become known.
Why did you leave Philadelphia?
Everybody has to leave Philadelphia to, in the music business, to even be heard of. Otherwise, you could be around here for years and years and be as great as people who are internationally known. And you could be in Philadelphia and nobody would know of you. It's close to New York, and a lot of people came here because of that during that period, you know, Terry? They came here to... Because it was a little cheaper, yet it was only 90 miles away from the big town where you had to make it eventually. So that, and along with that pressure with my fiancé at the time.
She was white, and it was hard to be an integrated couple in the city.
It was very difficult in Philadelphia to do it. You know, they closed the Downbeat eventually. They planted some kids up there underage and had them... served, and they closed it because it was just a mecca for integration, and that music bred integration, and it was anti-policy in Philadelphia, really. I think that's why they closed the Downbeat.
When you moved to New York, you played with a lot of the top musicians. You played with Charlie Parker, for instance, and I'm sure he had been one of the inspirations for you. Was it hard when you were actually playing with him in the band together to, was he still like a hero or a model to you? Were you awed by him at all?
Of course. And, you know, to play with Charlie Parker, you really felt useless. You just hoped that you wouldn't do something to mess up what was happening. Your job was just to stay out of the way, you know? And I got that feeling, going back to, jamming with the pros at the Downbeat. I stayed up there a year or so, a year and a half. And through that, Howard McGee came through there and played with that rhythm section, and he had heard of Jimmy and his band, and Bird had played with Jimmy's band. Jimmy had a great band around Philadelphia. They had transcribed all of the charts from Billy Eckstein and Dizzy's band, and this band really sounded good. So everybody who came to town knew about Jimmy's band, and they had dubbed him Little Bird with his alto. Coltrane was in the band. Benny Golson was in there. There was a trombone player, Mike Goldberg was an alto saxophonist, and there were some other players that around town, white players. It was an integrated band, too, as the music was. The music, the bebop era was the most interracial and, like, American product, if you want to use that word, but creation that ever was. And this defiance of the rule of segregation was probably what held it back for a long time.
Let me ask you a little bit about playing with Thelonious Monk. Did he point you in any different directions playing with him, since his playing was so idiosyncratic?
Monk's music, to me, required me to do exactly what I knew at the time, which was to play fundamental bass notes and indicate each progression as was laid out in the chord changes. So to play with Monk was a joy, because my note became really the foundation of his harmonic inferences. And so to play with Monk was beautiful with me. And the fact to play with all those guys, I was going to school, Terry, the whole 10 years of my first association with almost everybody in the jazz bebop era at that time.
Bass player Percy Heath, speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. Heath died yesterday at the age of 81. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1986 interview with Percy Heath, bass player and founding member of the Modern Jazz Quartet. Heath died yesterday at age 81. Before we return to their conversation, here's the Modern Jazz Quartet, recorded in 1952, the year it was formed.
The Modern Jazz Quartet didn't want to play clubs and played concert halls instead, and also frequently dressed in informal attire and in tuxedos. Was everyone in the group in agreement on that? Did you want to do that?
Why not? I had been getting dressed up all my life. I've got pictures of me. I go back now and people say, don't you ever get tired of wearing a tie? No, when I get dressed up, since I was 10 years old, I put on a tie. I got pictures of me, you know, with knickers on with a tie. So what is a tie? What does that mean? Why should you be in your shirt sleeves if you're a performer on a stage? Well, you know, when I was growing up in Philadelphia, our source of pride was the black bands, the black orchestras that used to come to the Lincoln Theater on South Street. It was on Lombard Street, Broad and Lombard. That was on the Chitlin' Circuit. You know about that. So-called Chitlin' Circuit. That's the black folks' entertainment circuit. There were several theaters in that circuit, one in Chicago, Baltimore, Washington, New York, and cities like that, and Philadelphia. And here's little old Percy. Every week I heard every band that came through Philadelphia. I met Fats Waller, you know, and Louis Armstrong,
And they
I
were
met
all
them all, and they every time they stepped out on the stage, they were sharp, baby. And that pride of a performer in jazz music, to be clean, to be sharp, not to look like a member of the orchestra, of the audience, that was, I can't get away from it, that's all.
The modern jazz quartet combined some classical style and jazz, and was, you know, really known as one of like the first third stream type groups. Yeah, you're gonna say something.
No, it's okay, Terry. Finish it. It's, I know what you're saying, but you know, these labels and
well, I guess what I was gonna ask you though. Yeah,
and stuff
I was gonna
like
ask you if you had to change your technique. Did you have to change your technique?
I didn't have any technique. I was going to school then every day. Every chart that John Lewis wrote for me was a challenge for me to learn how to do it and say what it was supposed to say and do my what was relegated as my responsibility as far as harmonic purity and get the best sound you can get and the intonation and on time and play your passage and speak up when you're supposed to and back up when you're not supposed to be. You know what I mean? This was all integrated in the writing of the music. How it should sound was left up to the musical director, and poor little Purse was just trying to do it. You know what I mean? The best I could. And that challenge would come, and as soon as I would accomplish something like Concord, which was a very difficult piece of music for me at that time to even attempt with my limited study and whatnot. But I did it, and I've heard some records later where it had gotten so fast, I don't believe I played it. You know what I mean? And some of those older records, eventually what they evolved to after playing them 5 or 6 years, it's amazing some of those recordings. I don't believe I did it, really, Terry, at that stage of my development. But as soon as I would accomplish that, up jumps another chart that was a little different and a little more challenging. Say, okay, you learned that, good. Now learn this.
How do you see the role of the bass in a quartet?
Okay. My idol, among my idols, is the father of all the bass players in the concept, Jimmy Blanton, who turned everything around in 1939 and 1940 with the Duke Ellington Organization, which was one of those groups that I went to the Lincoln to see, and this spotlight was put on this man, and he came down and played, and they kept him mic'd up in the band and whatnot. So my concept of a bass player in a group is to serve as a pulse and to imply harmonically what the progressions are in the song. I've never put too much emphasis on the soloing aspect of the bass. Contrary to my admiration for Jimmy Blanton and Oscar Pettiford, Ray Brown, and the other soloists, even Scott LaFaro later, who came along, who was a saxophone player when I met him. And 3 years later, he was really tearing up the bass, you know. And Red Mitchell with his fingering concept, and Mingus, who was a teacher of mine for a few lessons. Milt Hinton, Pops Foster, all different stylists on the bass, but all very important people in dictating what direction the bass was going into. But I've always felt that my place was at home, at the bottom of things. My whole concept is to be one voice. Like in the modern jazz quartet, there's four lines that go along horizontally as well as the vertical implications of motion of the music. But with that concept as being another voice on the stand, and generally a voice on which the other instruments build, I've never been able to get away from that concept. So that's the way I play the bass. I stick kind of close to the root of the matter. Like I was telling you about Monk, I felt so comfortable because the root was exactly what it called for, you know.
You were on the road maybe 10 out of 12 months a year for a long time.
For a while there, we were gone.
How do you keep together a home life? Because you had a family, too, when you're on the road that much.
I was married to, and still I'm married to, a wonderful lady from Philadelphia, and June is her name. And she wanted to be my wife. She wanted to have our children, and she wanted to be their mother. And she wanted to have that home for me to come back to off the road. She wanted me to give this music to the world. And that's her contribution to it, too, because we have three sons grown, and they're all doing what they want to do. They're not involved in music, but they can play. A couple of them can play.
Percy Heath, speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. He died yesterday at age 81. He's survived by his wife, June, and their three sons. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel Night and Day in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Letters from the Hive, an intimate history of bees, honey, and humankind by Stephen Buckman and Benning Replier. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, guess who? A hint. He starred in the sitcoms The Bob Newhart Show, Newhart, and Bob. A DVD of the first season of The Bob Newhart Show has just been released. Also, a review of the new film adaptation of the Douglas Adams classic, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. The first season of The Bob Newhart Show, the classic CBS sitcom from 1972 to 78, has just come out on DVD. Newhart had another successful TV series, playing a Vermont innkeeper in the 1982 to 90 sitcom called Newhart. In his first and most successful situation comedy, though, Newhart played Dr. Bob Hartley, a psychologist with lots of funny patients and with a beautiful and funny wife, played by Suzanne Pleshette. Here's a scene from the first season in which Bob is in session with one of his patients.
I just feel so helpless because he's keeping everything to himself. It's like I wasn't even around. He hardly ever speaks to me. Just leaves and never even says where he's going. And it's I even asked what time he'll be home. He just shrugged and says, I don't know. Dr. Hartley, I'm sure he has girlfriends, but he denies it.
Well, of course, Todd's 13 now.
I know he's growing up, but I just don't think he loves me.
Well, I'm sure he loves you, and one day he'll be secure enough to tell you. In the meantime, I just hold him a little more loosely. You know, if you let sleeping dogs lie, they'll never bite. I didn't mean that.
Before coming to TV, Newhart made his mark as a stand-up comic. His breakthrough album, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, made him a star, even though Newhart himself complained to me once that listening to it drove him crazy. Apparently, the producer of the album made the engineer shorten all of Newhart's trademark pauses, which, to Newhart, ruined the timing completely. Other than Newhart himself, though, few people seemed to notice or care. His Button-Down Mind recording was the first comedy album to top the record charts. Terry Gross spoke to Bob Newhart in 1998.
Now, you're Catholic, and when you were coming of age as a comic, I think a lot of the comics were Jewish comics who were getting their start in the Catskill Mountains, which was a largely Jewish resort area. And I'm wondering if you ever felt that ethnic comics had a built-in constituency, i.e. people of their ethnic group. And did you feel like you had that kind of, you know, because there was no borscht belt for you.
No.
Did you play the borscht belt at all?
No, I never have.
Right.
The Catskills, no.
Right. So did you feel like that...
I played the Poconos. That's as close as I ever came to the
right.
Catskills.
Okay. Did you feel like you were missing out on something, not being identified as an ethnic comic?
Well, you know, humor, I think, at that time was very regional. As I recall, it was. I remember Phil Foster doing routines about the Brooklyn Dodgers, and then television came along, and you had to make your humor continental. You couldn't make it regional anymore. It had to be. You had to find ways of not making it regional. Is what I'm trying to say. After some time, I realized that a lot of my friends, a lot of the comics are Jewish that I know, and they would refer to their Jewishness. And then I began referring to my Catholicism and what it's like to grow up as a Catholic, and began to realize how funny it is in many ways to grow up. It gives you a chance to kind of stand back and look at it. And find the humor in it.
What did you find funny about your Catholic upbringing?
Well, for instance, I said what the difference between Catholics and other religions is basically we have confession, and non-Catholics don't understand how you go in this little dark room and tell another human being like terrible things you've done during the week. But if you're raised Catholic, there are certain tricks you learn about going to confession, like you sit in the very last pew and you watch the two lines move into the confessional, and whichever line moves the fastest, that's the one you get in, because that priest wants to get out of there. And I remember the first time I did that, and it got a big reaction from the audience, and I realized, oh, I'm not the only one who did that.
You kind of treat it as if it was a long line at the supermarket instead of the confessional. Can you remember for us what the venues?
Yeah. That's interesting, because it does suggest they might have a confessional like, you know, 10 sins or less. You know,
the swift moving line.
I just thought of that.
That's good. Oh, you started doing stand-up during the era I've come to think of as the "you dirty rat" era, because every stand-up comic was compelled to do impersonations of James Cagney, and they also were required to do impersonations of Armstrong and Bogart, and you did some of those yourself.
I was never much of a impersonator. Comics kind of have an ear for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was never real good at it. What was interesting, and it certainly wasn't planned in any way, but the people I mentioned, Mike and Elaine and Shelley Byrne and myself and Johnny Winters and Lenny Bruce, it was a different kind of comedy than had preceded it. What had preceded it was material that could be stolen. In other words, take my wife, please.
Jokes.
Or jokes. I burn a hole in the coat. You like this jacket? It's a beautiful jacket. I got eight pairs of pants with it. With my luck, I'll burn a hole in the coat. You know, well, anybody could deliver that line. It wasn't personalized at all. But without realizing it, because I certainly wasn't aware of it. It's only in hindsight that I'm aware of it. You couldn't steal a Mike and Elaine routine or a Shelley Berman routine or a Bob Newhart routine or Johnny Winters routine. They would say, oh, that sounds like Johnny Winters. And so it became, it was just shift in American comedy that just happened. And I think why it happened was our audience was largely college kids, and they didn't have mother-in-laws, so mother-in-law jokes didn't mean anything to
them.
Thank
goodness.
You know? and so to that extent, the humor that was being done in nightclubs was irrelevant to them, and it was also very expensive. Nightclubs had a cover charge, and it was very expensive to go to a nightclub, and they didn't have the money, obviously. So they would buy a record. And get some pizza and some beer, and they'd all sit around and listen to one of us, and that was their nightclub, and I think that's what happened.
Right, and I mean, you had an onstage persona, like you said, it wasn't just jokes; it was a whole character that was telling these stories.
Exactly.
Bob Newhart is my guest. Let me ask you about the first sitcom that you did. The first Newhart show, you played a psychiatrist. It's common now to have stand-up comics with their own sitcoms. In fact, it's almost obligatory.
Right.
What was it like when you were a stand-up comic, having a sitcom built around you?
Well, it was paternalistic, really, because my manager, he and Mary Tyler Moore and Grant Tinker formed MTM Productions. And with the success of Mary's show, he came to me and he said, would you like to do a sitcom? And I said, yeah, I would, because it would keep me home, it keep me off the road, and I could spend some time with the family, which was very important. So we then went about trying to come up with a sitcom. We started out with what occupation is he? First of all, he's married, right? Okay, he's married, and I insisted on that we not have children, that we not have precocious children, because I hated those kind of shows where the kids are always bailing the dumb father out of some scrape he's gotten himself into, you know. And we love you, Daddy. Daddy's an idiot, but we do love you. And resolved I wasn't going to do that kind of show. And so then we started looking for occupations, and sat down with Lorenzo Music and Dave Davis, who I had worked with before, who had been writers on the Mary Tyler Moore show, and I knew Lorenzo from the Smothers Brothers show. And he said, well, you know, Bob is, he's a listener. He's like a reactor. He reacts to people. What occupation would lend itself to somebody who listens? And they said, well, how about a psychiatrist? So they came to me and said, what about a psychiatrist? I said, well, let's make him a psychologist, because I think a psychologist tends to deal with less severely disturbed people. And I didn't want to be making fun of severely disturbed people. I didn't want to be making fun of people with multiple personalities or schizophrenia or any
right.
of that stuff.
Suicidal depression, yes. Right. Just Mr. Carlin.
Mr. Carlin actually was worse at the end of 6 years than he was when he originally came to me. So he has a class action suit against me, I think, as do most of my group.
Bob Newhart speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Bob Newhart. They were talking about his first TV sitcom, The Bob Newhart Show, season one of which is now available on DVD.
Now, part of your persona in The Newhart Show was, he was the straight-laced, middle-of-the-road guy who was kind of dull.
Okay.
How did the writers come up with that aspect of it? Surrounded by a lot of nutty, eccentric people, but he was kind of dull.
Well, part of the success of Newhart was we tried to isolate what made the Bob Newhart Show work. And what seemed to make part of the Bob Newhart Show, at least the working environment of the Bob Newhart Show, the psychologist's office, was you had to have a situation where no matter how outrageous the statement was made by one of the patients, you couldn't react to it. You couldn't say, "That's the craziest thing I've ever heard, Mr. Carlin." You know, you'd have to say, "I remember one time I said, how did this week go?" He said, "It went very well." He said, "Oh, Saturday I was possessed by the devil." and I think my line was, "Okay, you want to go with that, Mr. Carlin?" You know, I couldn't say you were what. So we tried to find those elements and in Newhart, and we found them in the guests. No matter how unreasonable the guests were, you still had to kind of say, "Certainly, sir. Certainly, I'll send the maid up to the room right away."
Do you have a favorite episode from the first Newhart show?
I have several. There's one that kind of summed up comedy to me. I had an African-American insurance salesman came in, and he was very tall and muscular, and he wore the Djibouti, and he had a black Great Dane that he called Whitey, and he came to me, and he said, "I don't seem to be able to sell insurance policies," and I said, "Well, it has nothing to do with your personality. It's just that you kind of scare people, you know." And he said, "Well, thank you very much." So then we leave my office, and he said, "Is the men's room?" And I pointed out just down the hall, and he let the Great Dane stay there. So with that, Jerry comes out, and he comes over to me, and we start talking, and with the black gentleman comes back in, and he says, "Sit, Whitey." And with that, Jerry sits right on the reception desk, you know. And it got a huge laugh. And to me, it summed up what comedy does. It diffuses tensions in many areas. It gives you distance so that you can stand back and laugh at things.
Your shows have been rerun a lot on Nick at Night, and I think there was one, I don't know, 24 or 48-hour period when they did a whole Bob-a-thon. They were bringing on, I guess, a new series of yours, a new and rerun series of yours, and to introduce it and celebrate it, there was just hour after hour of continuous Newhart programs. What was that like for you?
Well, that's a tribute to the cast and to the writing, that the writing is still valid. And I had something to do with that. I told the writers, "Don't put any Gerald Ford jokes, you know, because this is going to be rerun and rerun and rerun, and we're going to look silly, you know. Because I knew then that it would go into syndication and people would be watching it, and we tried to get away from being trendy, and for that reason, and it holds up. The material holds up, which is largely a tribute to the writing.
The lapels and the sideburns don't hold up.
That's the only thing I know.
You wear a lot of plaid also.
Oh yeah.
No, well, see, whose idea was all the plaid?
My dresser was colored blind.
Are you kidding?
His name was Ralph, yeah. And he was such a nice guy, we didn't want to say anything, but...
Oh, that's so Newhart.
My wife...
that is like quintessential Newhart.
My wife would come in, and I'd be ready to go out, and I'm not good with colors either, so she would say, "Oh, my God, you're kidding." And I said, "What?" She said, "Oh, take the jacket off. It doesn't even come close to going with the shirt."
That's funny.
But, you know, of all careers to choose when you're colorblind, I mean, wardrobe seems like the last one.
Yeah, you think somebody might have said something about it at the studio, or...
I remember reading an article in a paper about a one-eyed bullfighter in... again, we get back to material coming out of the papers. A one-eyed bullfighter in Spain who was reapplying for license to fight the bulls. And it occurred to me then that if there is one occupation where you really want to have two good eyes, I think bullfighting would be right up toward the top, you know? I mean, of all professions to choose.
When I think of the Newhart character in your shows from the 60s, from the 70s and the 80s, I think of somebody who stammers a lot, not because he's unsure of what he feels, but because he can't really afford to reveal what he really feels, because it might be a little harsh or it might be a little too something. So there's this constant kind of like stammering to just, you know, cover up and to try to kind of package in a better way what it is that he's really thinking or feeling. Does that work for you?
Well, that's interesting, because the stammer is real. I didn't invent the stammer. I remember in the first year of Newhart, we were doing an episode, and it was running long. And one of the producers came up to me and said, "Can you run some of the words together? Because the show is really spreading." And I said, "Look, this stammer got me a home in Beverly Hills, and I'm not about to change it. So you better cut some words out of the script." No, it isn't. It isn't. An affectation. It's a way I speak. Although I do, I know what you're saying. It does help to get you over an uncomfortable moment. I think of him as a nice person who doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Right.
But at the same time, has difficulty saying, you know, what he means.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank
you very much.
Bob Newhart speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. The first season of his classic 1970s sitcom, The Bob Newhart Show, is now out on DVD. Coming up, a review of the new film, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This is Fresh Air. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, based on the imaginative ramblings of Douglas Adams, arrives in theaters this weekend as a brand new motion picture. But it's already been represented in several other media, including print, radio, and television. Because of its broadcast origins, I was eager to check out the latest incarnation. The first appearance of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in any form, was in 1978, when the six-episode comedy was broadcast by BBC Radio in England. In terms of science fiction and science reality, that was a long time ago. Star Wars, the original movie, the one that started it all, had come out just the year before, which was why Douglas Adams' weird comedy about intergalactic exploration was considered doable in the first place. There were no personal computers then, much less the sort of handheld encyclopedic reference Adams imagined in the title of his story. Today, you can look at Adams' portable Hitchhiker's Guide, with its helpful animation and warm-sounding computer voice, and imagine a BlackBerry, or some other modern miracle of engineering. Back when Adams wrote his radio series, though, one of the modern miracles, which he made fun of mercilessly, was the digital watch. We've come a long way, baby, and so has The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. After its radio run, the story was adapted to the theater, and then, in 1980, as a novel, the first in a hugely successful series. A version of the story was released on record albums. This was long before CDs. And National Public Radio imported the original radio series and broadcast it in 1981. That same year, a six-part TV miniseries was presented in England, starring Simon Jones, David Dixon, and, as the voice of the computerized Hitchhiker's Guide, Peter Jones. It was seen in the USA shortly thereafter, and that's when I fell in love with the story. It's available now, by the way, on DVD from BBC Video. The TV version was a low-budget affair with lots of cheesy special effects, but it also had a dry sense of humor that shone through perfectly. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy begins with the destruction of Earth, after which we follow one of its only survivors, a quiet Englishman named Arthur Dent, who has been rescued by a researcher doing fieldwork updating entries for the computerized Guide to the Galaxy. Here's how the guide and the TV series sounded more than 20 years ago, when Peter Jones provided the voice of the soothing, informative, handheld computer.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a wholly remarkable book. The introduction starts like this. Space, it says, is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the street to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Listen. And so on. After a while, the style settles down a bit and it starts telling you things you actually need to know. Like the fact that the fabulously beautiful planet Bethselamin is now so worried about the cumulative erosion caused by over 10 billion visiting tourists a year that any net imbalance between the amount you eat and the amount you excrete whilst on the planet is surgically removed from your body weight when you leave. So, every time you go to the lavatory there, it is vitally important to get a receipt.
Hollywood first approached Adams about turning Hitchhikers into a movie in 1979. He did enough work on it over the years that he's credited with Kerry Kirkpatrick as co-author of the screenplay, even though he died in 2001. The problem, as Adams often pointed out, is that it takes time to destroy the Earth in the beginning of the movie, and that doesn't leave much time for the rest of the story. That's why a TV miniseries was ideal, and why I was so skeptical about this new movie version. Even though computerized special effects and puppetry have progressed to the point where all of Adams' crazy imaginings can be put on the screen, can they be put there in a coherent and entertaining fashion? The answer, I'm both surprised and delighted to report, is yes. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, directed by Garth Jennings, ought to please longtime Douglas Adams fans, and make plenty of new ones. The movie stars Martin Freeman as Arthur Dent, and it's a perfect bit of casting. He played the polite porn star in Love Actually, and the likable paper salesman Tim in the brilliant British version of The Office. Mos Def plays Ford Prefect, the alien researcher who saves Arthur from certain death. Zooey Deschanel, the sister in Almost Famous and Will Ferrell's girlfriend in Elf, plays Trillian, one crew member of the spaceship that gives Arthur and Ford a ride. And Sam Rockwell, in a delightful role that's equal parts George W. Bush and Wayne Newton, plays another, the two-faced and two-headed alien, Zaphod Beeblebrox. All these characters and performances are playful and delightful, and the fun doesn't stop with them. One of my favorite characters, the super intelligent and super depressed robot named Marvin, is a real standout here. In this new movie version, he has the body of a metallic Charlie Brown, big round head, constant sad slouch. He also has the perfect voice, provided by Alan Rickman. In this scene, Marvin welcomes cosmic hitchhikers Arthur and Ford to their new spaceship. Well, welcomes may be too strong a word.
Ghastly, isn't it? I've been ordered to take you up to the bridge. Oh, please yourselves. Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they ask me to take you up to the bridge. Call that job satisfaction, because I don't. You can thank the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation for building robots with GPP.
What's GPP?
Genuine people personalities. I'm a personality prototype. You can tell, can't you?
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, like Marvin, is a lot smarter than most things around him. In the area of science fiction especially, you won't find many movies as clever or as amusing as this is. And as a bonus, it also provides the answer to life, the universe, and everything. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Joyce Lieberman provided technical assistance for today's show. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the father of underground comics, R. Crumb. Since the 60s, his strips have delighted audiences, changed the medium, questioned stereotypes, and sometimes just creeped people out. His new book is the R. Crumb Handbook. Join us for the next Fresh Air.